looking like mother sky. I see madness is looking like mother sky. Tell me about the price in your eyes. Tell me about the price of your eyes.
Doing well.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Hello, you're listening to News 101. Today is Friday, September 27th. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Christine. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:07 and time for another full hour of independent news. Today's broadcast will feature UBC headlines, an interview with Elizabeth Ormandy on animal research practices at UBC, as well as two segments on Syria, which has been a hot topic in international news at the moment. First, an interview with Chris Erickson, UBC political science professor, and as well as a little segment that our correspondent Alistair has made on the geopolitical importance of Syria. We also have a panel led by news correspondent Josh on the recent Polaris Prize debate around the quote-unquote acceptance letter from Godspeed You Black Emperor. We also have a new segment that just started with our correspondent Christine called Student Hot Topic. Today's Student Hot Topic was the question being, was the Truth and Reconciliation event a success? So these are all things that you can look forward to on News 101.
We also have your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, plus headlines covering local news from around Vancouver, provincial and national news from across Canada, and news from around the world brought to you by Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News.
So now for your campus local headlines.
UBC professor Jai Yang Zhao has recently published an article in the journal Science. His research suggests that poverty can impair our cognitive abilities. Exhaustion caused by poor health and overworking, for example, can lead to less mental bandwidth. Zhao states previous accounts of poverty have blamed the poor for their personal failings or an environment that is not conducive to success. This research could help to refine systems to help aid those in need and prevent homelessness. UBC engineers have been working with First Nations communities to try and help achieve an easier and more reliable way to access clean water. Many of the current water systems in place do little to keep contaminants out of their drinking water. Research into how to better control the levels of E. coli and other bacteria, as well as manage meltwater, is being done with First Nations students in a push to help them understand and better and become interested in the engineering field.
Every year, Canadian institutions and organizations are named to the annual list of Canada's top employers for young people in 2013, which now includes UBC. So recognized for its ability to help develop and refine skills, UBC has been applauded for the experience that it gives to its students.
Those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101.
We are now going to take a very quick break, playing some public service announcements, and we'll be right back with you.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot! It's too hot! Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable?
turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Project Space presents the second annual Vancouver Art Book Fair, a two-day festival of artists publishing in the heart of downtown at the Vancouver Art Gallery. Come immerse yourself in the awesomeness of books, magazines, zines, and printed ephemera. Artist talks, workshops, performances, panel discussions, and installations will provide you with a multi-sensory experience that expands beyond the printed page. Free and open to public, the event takes place on October 5th and 6th from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, visit VancouverArtBookFair.com. So welcome back to News 101. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thank you for being with us. We're going to go straight to our interview with Christopher Erickson on Syria, and we'll be playing Morgan's segment after. So this is me talking to Christopher Erickson, a political science professor at UBC, about Syria and his general opinions about what's happening, how the event's folding out. Enjoy.
Stop! Hello? In Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Tonight, in Vancouver, at Fortune Sound Club. And Blondtron is there.
So I have Chris Erickson here with me today. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well.
Perfect. So we can start with the questions. First one was basically your thoughts on recent U.S. intervention in Syria and the possible end result of this intervention. Basically, are we looking at another Afghanistan or Iraq?
It's, I don't think we're looking at another Afghanistan or Iraq. The stated intent of this intervention is really to degrade the Syrian capacity to use chemical weapons. That raises a whole lot of questions on its own. But every time there's even the remotest hint at sort of boots on the ground conflicts, as is the case in Afghanistan or Iraq, it's backed away from very, very quickly. You take a look at some of the statements that John Kerry said the other day, and he kind of said that well, maybe boots on the ground is still out there, but he backed away from it almost instantly. I don't think this is going to look like Afghanistan or Iraq. I think it's probably more going to look like, say, Kosovo in 1999. You know, it is looking like this is going to go forward. So my suspicion is that it's going to look more like Kosovo, which is a number of airstrikes and then not much happening on the ground, really. Okay. I suspect it'll be more like that.
So they're coming in, they'll be making those airstrikes and then backing out?
I'm thinking that's probably what's going to happen. You know, I don't think that the American population right now is in any state to support an on-the-ground conflict. As a matter of fact, I think they're much more likely to say absolutely not to that. So I'm thinking that we're probably going to see some cruise missile strikes, maybe a few airstrikes, but not much on-the-ground presence.
Okay. Because of that question, I was wondering as well, in terms of the location of Syria, many countries, most notably Iran, have said that this U.S. intervention is a step in gaining a geostrategic position close to Iran and in protection of Israel. So, and also there's the U.N. Security Council who's vetoed the decision. So it's for that reason that there's that question, is the U.S. doing this for their own benefit?
Yeah. That's, again, a tricky one, because to be perfectly honest, what is its benefit here? I mean, if you take a look at this from, say, the perspective of sort of your standard realist, where things are done in you know, sort of in the name of national interest.
Yeah.
There isn't a whole lot here in the way of straightforward national interest.
Okay.
Unless you want to get really cynical and say, okay, well, maybe the people that are going to benefit are the people that are making cruise missiles, and they'll sell a few more. But that doesn't seem to be nearly enough to explain what's going on. I think it's too simple to say that it's in the U.S.'s sole benefit. I do think that this action is motivated more for a desire to sort of maintain international norms, particularly with regards to the use of chemical weapons. But it raises a whole ton of issues because the United States, in being willing to step up and say, look, these norms matter, which I think is really what the strikes would be about, is also putting itself in the position of being the one to decide what matters. And so
and
the
to
rhetoric
tell
is really,
other countries what the rules are?
Yes, exactly. That's the sort of rock in a hard place here is, sending in airstrikes, I can't see how it's going to absolutely benefit the American position, you know, overall.
Yeah.
In terms of enforcing these international norms, I can see that for sure.
Okay.
But then you do run into the problem of why is it the Americans get to decide which norms get enforced and which don't, and when?
Yeah, especially due to the veto done by the
U.S. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that really does complicate the matter. Like, there's no question. I kind of get the feeling that if Obama had his way, we'd have the UN on his side.
Yeah.
I think that's what he's aiming for. At least that's, maybe I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt here, but that seems to be what he's aiming for.
Okay. And I guess what I was wondering in terms of the strategic placement was the fact that it's in the Middle East, and we all know America's relationship with the Middle East, especially in recent past. With Iran and their own nuclear weapons. And so thinking maybe the U.S. is trying to gain this position close to these countries that they've felt threatened by. But I guess, again, if it's just airstrikes and then they're backing out right away, maybe that has nothing to do with it.
Well, I suspect, certainly the United States is looking for a more democratic presence on the ground. They're definitely looking for that, which again raises a whole series of complications. Because what if the demos, that is the people, don't want what you want them to want?
Yeah.
Then are you still pro democracy or not?
Yeah.
And that's again one of these big thorny issues that I think is coming out of this. Certainly they want more friendly regimes in the area, and they also want to pay attention to a lot of what's happening with literally the voice of the people. When you look at where the Syrian conflict started, it was originally protest much along the lines of what we saw in Tunisia and Egypt and the early stages of Libya,
exactly.
which were sort of large scale protests against the government. They were then clamped down on it and it escalated.
Yeah.
And I think the United States, as being a proponent of democracy, wants to give the people of Syria a voice. But at the same time, what if that voice is calling for something that the Americans don't want them to call for?
Yeah.
That's the big complication. You see the same thing in Egypt, really. A very similar kind of a thing.
Okay. So Russia, China, and Iran have all stated opposition with the U.S.'s planned attacks on Syria. Is there now a possibility for an even bigger conflict to arise from the disagreement of these eastern countries?
Mm-hmm. I believe that there is. Now, the likelihood of an open conflict with Russia and China, a hot war with them, I think it's very remote. I really don't think that that's going to be happening anytime soon.
Okay.
But certainly there's more than enough opportunity to expand any diplomatic distance that's between the countries. You've also got, Iran is in the area. And so certainly, and they have a lot of interest in the area. I was reading recently where Iran has called for militants in a variety of countries, including Iraq, to attack American installations there if strikes on Syria take place. And so I think it's pretty clear that there is at least the possibility of a wider conflict based out of what's happening in Syria. You look at Turkey has moved tanks to its border, and Israel is conducting all these missile tests to show that it's ready to respond. So tensions are pretty darn high there.
Yeah.
You know, the Russians have said, look, if you go after the chemical, if you go after chemical weapons depots, who's to say that you're not just going to smash the security systems around them and then give terrorists access to those same materials? If you go after their nuclear capacity, you know, what's the effect of that? And they approached the IAEA very recently to look into what the effects of a strike on Syrian nuclear capacity would be. You know, particularly some of the reactors that they've got going in various places in there. I know that China is talking about, you know, if this strikes take place, we're going to see a spike in oil prices, and that's going to slow down. Yeah, that's going to slow down global economic growth, and so they're kind of looking at from all different angles. There's people that have reasons not to do this, and yet at the same time, I don't think any of them are saying, oh yeah, chemical weapons are perfectly fine. Let's let anybody that wants to use them use them. I don't think anybody is saying that, nor do I think that they want to send that message. Okay. So it gets. This is the thing, this is what makes Syria so interesting, is that it's so complicated and there doesn't seem to be a really crystal clear answer here.
Exactly, especially in the midst of the economic crisis and especially in the midst of everybody constantly fearing an even bigger crisis to come out of it, because I know that a lot of the concern was economic primarily.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So in terms of Canada, although Canada is currently not contemplating military action, do you think there is a possibility of eventual involvement, if not with NATO, at least in a position offering relief?
Yes, I would say that there definitely is. Canada for a long time has kind of liked to position itself as taking the moral high ground. And I think offering relief is an easy, well, relatively easy way to do that. I know that you know Canada has said it supports the strikes, but it's not going to get involved in them, and it sort of labeled its position, according to Baird anyway, as a strong moral stand.
Okay. Is this mean blue helmets, or is this?
Well, I think they're going to be offering food and medical supplies for sure, and again, Baird himself has said they're going to be doing this. In a big way, were his words. So I think that humanitarian assistance, not so much peacekeeping as in blue helmets, people on the ground separating the hostile forces, but making sure that food and medicine is available, most likely to those that are opposed to Assad. I would think that that's probably where most of it's going to go. I'm not certain on that, but I would assume that that's probably it. I do think that Canada is going to sort of take that moral high ground stance and say, look, we're helping out on the right side here.
Okay.
That seems to be the most likely, and all evidence is pointing in that direction.
Okay, kind of the middle ground. We're on both sides, Canada. We're okay
well,
with everyone.
Well, I think that they're going to take sort of we're on the side of human rights and democracy kind of a thing.
Okay.
That kind of a stand, and if the perception is Assad is not on that side, well then I don't think that they're going to be giving much support, if any, on that side of the conflict.
Okay. So
I think Canada's position might also, and this is, you know, this is far from clear, but it might also mitigate some of the input of some of the more radical groups on the opposition side in Syria. You know, if you're being supplied with the material that you need to survive through the Canadian government, it's slightly, you know, maybe you have a better chance of looking what, say, groups like Al-Qaeda are saying, or groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda are saying in Syria. And if they were supplying all the stuff, maybe you'd have a more favorable view of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of those intervening countries that are there for aid, what does that say about the roles and duties of the countries around the world in response or lack of response to Syria and its growing number of refugees? Because there has been refugees in Jordan, in Lebanon, mostly those two countries. And I know that a lot of the calls from Syria have been calls saying to other countries, hey, we need your help right now, and not very many countries other than the countries around us are helping us.
Yes. I do think that again, Canada's roles kind of expresses that. These are the big questions, and you start seeing really in practice, you start seeing the conflict of different theoretical approaches here, to studying international relations and the like. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you have sort of traditional kind of realist approaches that says that might argue this is a Syrian problem, let the Syrians sort it out. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got more liberal approaches that say, no, this is the humanity that we all need to be caring for, and this is everybody's problem.
Yes.
And these really, there doesn't seem to be a clear answer here. And certainly, it really depends on how you're framing the issue. As I mentioned before, I don't think that anybody is going to look at this and say, well, this is action or non-action is an endorsement of chemical weapons. I think that, however, if there isn't action taken, there's a danger that people could see that. Okay. Could see that non-action as being, well, it's okay to use them.
Yeah.
That's a distinct danger. It's not a necessary outcome, but it's certainly a distinct possibility. At the same time, acting runs you into this problem, particularly since it's the United States that will be taking the lead on that, runs you into the problem of, well, who are they to decide what I want? And that, again, clashes with these different theoretical approaches to understanding what's happening in world politics today. The question then becomes, what do you do if not intervention, then what? Everything else seems to kind of not be really working all that well. Again, it's a rock and a hard place situation, because if Assad goes, the most organized groups on the ground right now seem to be those that are affiliated with Al-Qaeda and sort of this more radical, more radical factions, more extremist groups. They seem to be much more organized than other groups, or at least they're making the most noise.
Exactly. And I think there's another problem, which is when we're helping, are we going to be helping the people, or are these people part of terrorist groups? Who's the good guys? Who's the bad guys? There's always those blurred lines between good and bad. And are we going in to help, or are we going in to crush this regime?
Yeah.
So I think that's also another confusion.
Well, that's just it. Our priority, we want friends and we want a democratic population, but one of the issues with a democracy is that they don't always choose. Different populations aren't always going to choose what, say, the United States would want them to choose.
Yeah.
And they could still be perfectly democratic in doing so. And this poses a real issue. And again, I don't see a crystal clear way out of this. I mean, maybe one of the things that we should do is be sending in support for groups other than the extremist groups, political support in the sense of sending in people that will show them how to organize politically.
That's actually an interesting idea.
I mean, maybe that's an option.
Yeah.
And so then, if you can have different organized groups, then the discussion isn't dominated by just the most organized group.
Exactly.
Which is right now the extremists.
And giving people their own opportunity to help themselves instead of coming in and showing them how
yeah.
they should be living.
Yeah,
that's
I mean, personally, I do think that there is, I think, a duty to look out for people. Just because they're a certain distance away doesn't mean that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's also a duty, I think, to respect people's right to self-determination.
Yeah.
And again, there's no clear path here.
Yeah.
This is nobody goes into politics and comes out with clean hands ever.
Yeah.
And this is a perfect example of that. There's no clear way here. I think the best that we can do is realize that whatever we do, we're always operating on partial information. And whatever steps we take, we better be very careful, because we could very well be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If we can be aware of that, if we can sort of maintain that stance, I think it'll allow us to listen to perhaps more options that we otherwise may not have been able to hear.
Exactly. Well, I guess we're just going to have to see how it unfolds and learn from that and
mm-hmm.
try and contribute along the way.
Well, I think that's it. And I think what I like, as I'm seeing these debates, what I like is that you've got the mainstream media that's pumping out one message, and then you've got a really large-scale public backlash, you know, in North America and in the United States in particular, that doesn't seem to be going along lockstep with the media portrayals of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that gives me a bit of hope. You know, that gives me a bit of, you know, we don't just have to be automatons here. We can start thinking for ourselves. And I like this idea. You know, even if we have to deal with some really ugly, messy stuff, hey, at least we're the ones dealing with it.
Yeah, it's not
something we just have to sit back and let the powers that be deal with it.
No, you're right. And as much discussion we can have as possible, I think that's also a good way to get through it and a good way to think about new solutions.
Yeah, and at the same time, we've got to do something because people are dying.
Exactly.
You know, so it's not just about the discussion. It's about putting it into practice, too.
Yeah.
Knowing that whatever you do probably isn't going to be clean and probably isn't going to be the best answer, maybe the best in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, this is why you have to sort of mitigate your responses to some extent.
Yeah, it's before we finish this, I was just going to say it's interesting for you to say that because, you know, before coming into the interview, there's always this kind of bad guy image of the U.S. trying to come in and take over everything. But at the same time, they are the only ones actually doing something about it. And in that way, like we have to say that that is positive, that they're at least making an action and making a decision to do something because mm-hmm. nobody else has.
Well, yeah, to a large extent, yes. And when you frame it that way, it's a very, I think, positive development. When you frame it, you know, a different way, if this is just the United States throwing its weight around, then it's not so positive. And there's no crystal clear answer between which it is.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your answers and your insight. Really.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks. All right.
All right.
Bye, Chris.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So that was Christopher Erickson.
So I have Chris Erickson here with me today. How are you doing, Chris?
And there goes the interview again. No, that was Christopher Erickson, a political science professor at UBC, talking to us about his insights on Syria. Next up, we have Morgan Yee, our wonderful co-director. She did an interview with Elizabeth Ormandy on animal research practices at UBC.
Elizabeth, welcome to News 101.
Thank you.
So what did you come here to tell us about today?
Well, I came here to talk about the UBC Animal Welfare Program and some postdoctoral research that I'm doing as part of that research program. So the Animal Welfare Program are a research-based program at UBC in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, and our aim is to use scientific evidence to improve the lives of animals under human stewardship, whether that is farm animals, companion animals, lab animals, or wildlife, so any animals that just are under human stewardship. And we'll do certain research studies to look at animal well-being and behavior with the aim of improving the lives of those animals. So my own research specialty is in laboratory animal welfare, particularly the ethics of using animals in experiments. UBC practices animal research as an institution. It's government funded to do so.
Right.
And so I'm really interested in the ethical governance of animal research practices, especially things like openness and transparency of animal research practices at institutions like universities that are publicly funded through mm-hmm. government dollars, and also accountability for those practices, how we hold institutions accountable to the animal research practice. And through those practices of openness, transparency, accountability, how we can build trustworthiness. So, you know, I'm a citizen of Vancouver, I'm a citizen of Canada, and oftentimes, you know, there's people that really just don't know what happens to the animals in research, and I feel like it's a practice that could be more open. So I'm kind of playing with different ideas of how that could happen. So I'm doing a series of focus groups that is actually just asking people who share institutional space at UBC mm-hmm. with the animals that are used in research. I'm asking them their opinions on what would constitute, you know, ethical practice and ethical governance. Yeah. So I'm kind of putting the question to other people.
Now, who exactly are you looking for to form this group?
So I'm doing five different focus groups with five different stakeholders.
Okay.
So I've already done focus groups with animal care staff on campus,
okay,
who are involved with the day-to-day running of animal care facilities that are lab-based.
And if I can just cut in there, how many animals do we actually have on campus right now that are being, you know, research is being conducted on them?
Sure, I can't remember the exact figure. UBC actually is the first university to publicly publish their animal numbers.
Okay.
So there is a website.
Okay.
I think it's something in the thousands. And
wow.
Yeah, so the numbers are very clearly published on UBC's website. And that was a really, I was in full support of that decision, right? Like, in terms of being more open. And that's something that I talk about in the focus groups, whether, you know, that is a welcome decision on the part of UBC, whether it goes far enough in terms of openness and accountability. So I've so far done focus groups with animal care staff and animal advocates in the local Vancouver community that are part of various animal rights groups.
Okay.
And my three remaining ones will be with UBC students across the disciplines, not only in science. So I'm really interested in giving students a say, because I think they are a key stakeholder in this institutional university-based practice. UBC researchers, again, from across the disciplines, and by researchers I mean anyone from grad students, postdocs, to principal investigators that hold research grants.
Okay.
And finally, UBC residents that live on campus but don't work for the university, because again, they're sharing the institutional space. So they're my three remaining ones. I guess by way of this interview, I'm advertising the fact that I would like to recruit participants, so if anyone falls in those categories, they're welcome to contact me at the Animal Welfare Program. There's a website online for the Animal Welfare Program in Land and Food Systems faculty, so I'm relatively easy to find on the postdoc researcher page.
Yeah, and we'll provide that information on our Facebook page as well.
Perfect.
So in our discussion just prior to this, we did talk about whether your goal is to end animal research at UBC. Can you just speak a little bit more about that?
Sure. So I think that oftentimes animal welfare falls in this middle ground, which is really interesting. So there is the opinion out there that the use of animals in research should stop. Like, there's definitely abolitionist groups. I'm not part of one actively. Ultimately, I would like to see the replacement of animals in research, but I also value individual animal lives and animal rights, and I'm also a realist, and I know that animal research isn't going to stop anytime soon. And so in the meantime, I'm more interested in the question of how we give a good life to the animals that are in labs right now. So that's where I fall on the spectrum, I guess. There are plentiful animal rights groups all over the world that would...
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure many students have noticed there are posters all around campus with pictures of a cat being experimented on, and, you know, $1,000 rewards for photos. That's a separate organization from you, correct?
It's separate to the Animal Welfare Program, yes. STOP University of British Columbia Animal Research, or SUBCAR, is an animal rights organization. We've had some really amazing discussions with them, actually, like, you know, in terms of that political voice being important. No matter whether you agree or disagree with it, I think it's very important to have all perspectives out there in the interests of deliberation and dialogue about issues that can be considered pretty contentious. So yeah, animal welfare kind of falls in the middle ground. If you have SUBCAR on the extreme left of kind of wanting this like abolition, and then you have people who are very in defense of animal research because of the collective good that it provides in terms of human and animal and medicine and environmental benefits and things. So I would say that, you know, personally, I can't speak for the Animal Welfare Program necessarily, but for myself, I kind of fall somewhere in the middle in terms of understanding why people would be both for and against that practice.
Right.
Yeah.
And then one of the things we briefly discussed was the dairy farm out in Agassiz.
Absolutely.
Which does sort of fall to the left, right? Because it's talking about, it's a little bit experimental, because you're looking at advances in dairy cow life.
Exactly. So the UBC Animal Welfare Program has a dairy farm, the Dairy Education Research Centre up in Agassiz, and we get a lot of industry funding to actually look at the lives of dairy cows and improve the life of dairy cows on farms. So it's a fully functioning working dairy farm, but we also are very privileged to be able to work with the farm manager and do lots of really cool animal behavior experiments to identify kind of early behavioral indicators of disease, feeding behavior, social behavior, like all kinds of really cool stuff. So the dairy center actually is very open to visitors. Okay. So, you know, if anyone wants to go visit, just drop us a line. There's an open house about once a year, I think.
Okay.
So that's usually posted on our website somewhere that we're having the open house up at Agassiz.
Okay. Yeah. And so if listeners do want to get in touch with you, the mm-hmm. best way is through your website, or do you have an email address that you prefer people to get in touch with?
You can contact me at my email address. It's ehormandy, that's my initials plus surname, at gmail.com.
Okay.
That's my personal email address. And yeah, anyone is welcome to either contact me, come visit us for lunch. We meet, we're a very kind of collegial research program. We have lunch together most days.
Okay.
And if anyone wants to come and learn more about the program, you're absolutely welcome to come have lunch with us one day. And I'm currently in charge of the lunchtime visitors, so I'm also the contact person for that. So anyone is welcome to drop me a line.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
So that was Morgan speaking to Elizabeth about animal cruelty at UBC. Next up, we have Christine, who did a segment asking students about the truth and reconciliation that happened last week.
Ignorant aren't the ones that go, so I think it's fairly hopeless. But I mean, it's just good to respect people that have had hardships in their life, unjustly, obviously.
Huh. All right. Well, thanks so much for your guys' time.
Thank you.
No problem.
Okay. Hi, my name's Christine, and I have
Eric.
Eric with me. Eric, what faculty are you in?
Arts.
Arts faculty. Okay.
Yeah.
Third year?
Yes.
Third year. Awesome. So what do you think about the effectiveness of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, I think it's relatively effective in raising awareness, which is pretty important, because it's kind of ridiculous that so many people don't know about it. So it's been relatively effective that way, and in raising questions on how to properly reconcile. But the reconciliation itself, I'm not sure how effective it's been that way.
Hmm. What do you think is the most effective way to get the message out?
To get the message out? What message?
The message of the residential school, is like the history that Haihana has had.
I think, you know, it has to be taught throughout school and not just, you know, like a quarter of a page in a social studies textbook. It's a pretty important part of our history that we completely disregard, so I think it has to be brought out through the school system and also, you know, in the media when necessary, you know. It's not talked about in any way, so most importantly in schools, and then that will bring it out hopefully later on.
That's really good. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you to Christine for that. That's really nice to get people's opinions on an event after it's happened, especially something like Truth and Reconciliation. It was kind of a debated topic on campus and off campus. So right now we have Alistair here. Hey, Alistair. Alistair is our news correspondent. He is doing, he has a piece right now he's going to do about geopolitics of Syria.
Geopolitics of Syria, indeed. Right, so this is a report on Syria. I wanted to do give it a different perspective of what was actually going on, rather than focusing on who did the chemical weapon, who carried out that attack. This is more a report based upon or focusing upon the geopolitical importance of Syria. So to begin with, I wish to say that this issue has no black and white solution, like we're so often led to believe by watching mainstream news. This is a really, really complex geopolitical conflict that involves the entire region of the Middle East directly, with its outcome and ongoing disputes. There's a lot of hypocrisy going on right now, as there always is with any issue. First of all, I would just like to dispel any illusion that this is an issue of supporting democracy or a humanitarian mission of any manner. Why? Well, this can plainly be seen by the fact that two main regional proponents of the Free Syrian Army are absolute monarchies, namely the royal family of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who have poured millions in supporting rebel fighters to topple the Syrian government and also encourage civilian Syrian expats within their own countries to return and fight against the regime. Also, it would seem that the West's wise point of view is that we can save Syria by bombing it and arming groups that oppose al-Assad, including some of the most violent offshoots of al-Qaeda. And to be fair, these days when we say al-Qaeda, it really doesn't amount to anything more than Islamic fundamentalists. They don't really have, it's not like a HQ in some cave in Afghanistan. It's not like that. Also, since then, I don't really think the West has ever had a problem with chemical use or chemical weapon use. We supplied weapons to Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war of the late 70s and early 80s in order to topple a new Islamic Republic, which was done by Ayatollah Khomeini. This essentially kicked out all influence from the West. And I'm not sure the exact date, but they did take over the U.S. embassy, I think taking 140 people into as hostages. The U.S. also sold the same kind of warheads to Iran to raise money to fund the Contras in Nicaragua as well. There was also a report done by Patrick Coburn, which stated that in Fallujah in 2004, during the one of the most brutal battles during the Iraq invasion, he found that there were levels of cancer and leukemia beyond levels found of that in Hiroshima after some reports of American chemical strikes. The U.S. is also in possession of several hundred tons of chemical warheads, which it claims shall be destroyed by 2012, even though the Non-Proliferation Treaty of Chemical Weapons was signed and ratified by the US in 1993, so a decent amount of time ago. For the most part, I don't really want to focus on the use of chemical weapons within Syria, because it's not exactly important, and it doesn't make much of a difference who used them. Not even for the US, who are advocating for a small-scale invasion before evidence even came out who was actually responsible, and if it had indeed actually occurred. I think the number is about 1,400 who were killed. But one can't help but be reminded when Americans present this, actually the West in general, so that's France and the UK, present, you can't help but be reminded when Colin Powell, during a speech to the UN in 2003, showing a vial he claimed demonstrated Iraq's belligerent intentions to bomb all of the Western world and destroy it, obviously turned out to be a complete farce. What should really be examined by any person or group wishing to investigate the situation in Syria is the geopolitical importance of Syria's position. I often find the popularized Latin phrase, qui bono, used by Cicero in his defense of Milo, meaning for whom is it good, which is inclusive in its meaning of the phrase, follow the money, a phrase popularized by Jesse Ventura. Moving swiftly past the wisdom held by Ventura's words, what must be understood is how Syria is viewed by its surrounding countries, and what they have to lose or gain from Syria and the conflict going on within. Israel has already launched four major strikes against what it's called weapons that were intended for Hezbollah, an act that is seen in all eyes of international law, constitutes war. Holding key interests in the instability of Syria and across the Middle East. If Syria was to fall into the hands of rebels, an already splintered and disorganized group of various affiliates, many experts believe that geographically Syria would be broken up between the newly warring factions, between the multitude of religious diasporas within Syria. This would then allow Israel to encroach upon territories within Syria, as they've done in the past, with the Golan Heights. And this, they would claim, as you know, it constitutes a threat to national security with these little diasporas within Syria, the break-offs of Syria, because it's one of the largest melting pots culturally and religiously within the Middle East, having, I think, maybe 10% of its population Christian, who are actually a great threat from the Islamic fundamentalists who are currently fighting, who claim that they're going to, well, not all of the Free Syrian Army, but definitely sections within it, who claim that they are out to essentially wipe out the Christian population within Syria. Furthermore, it also applies that divisions within Arab states really allows for Israel to continue to build their settlements in the West Bank, whilst the Arab attention is focused on their domination over each other. Whilst they're warring and between the Sunnis and the Shias, it's a great advantage for them. It benefits Israel greatly, because obviously attention is not focused upon their settlements within the West Bank. For Saudi Arabia, Assad is viewed as an enemy due to his obvious Shia religion, and also with his ties to the government in Iran. The royal family views this as a stepping stone into diminishing Iran's military influence in the region, those being the two greatest powers militarily. This is much true of America's position, who still saw, after being kicked out of Iran in 1979 with the Islamic Revolution of the Ayatollah. Unsurprisingly, their interest in Iran would have maybe something to do with the fact that it has the highest gas reserves in the world and the third highest in terms of oil supplies. Crude oil, that is. In the end, we have to remember that there have been over 100,000 deaths in this conflict so far, and around 1.8 million people displaced who have spilled over into Turkey and Lebanon and many other places, but specifically those two. A great majority of whom have fled the country due to the murderous proxy fighters that have come from the surrounding nations to fight for Sunni dominance within Syria. They are currently estimated to be about 40,000 of these fighters, constituting around 30 to 40% of the actual Free Syrian Army. So 30 to 40% of the Free Syrian Army are foreigners and not Syrian in any way. If we're purely interested in the stability of the region, it should be argued that all military support for the rebels should stop. However, we must remember America's commitment to stability and democracy in the region. No phrase better accounts for this commitment than a statement published by WikiLeaks made by General Wesley Clark in 2007, stating that, and I'm quoting directly, we are going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq, and then Syria, Libya, Lebanon, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with Iran. The reality is, there is no interest in stability in terms of the Western point of view. And that's the report.
Thank you, Alistair. That was awesome. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with News 101.
You already bike, walk, and take transit to get around, but sometimes you just got to drive. At Moto the Car Co-op, you save big with us covering gas, insurance, maintenance, and monthly parking. Mention this ad when signing up for Moto, and we'll give you $35 in free driving. For other perks and more information, visit moto.coop.
So my name is Christine, and...
Georgia.
Project Space presents the second annual Vancouver Art Book Fair, a two-day festival of artists publishing in the heart of downtown at the Vancouver Art Gallery. Come immerse yourself in the awesomeness of books, magazines, zines, and printed ephemera. Artist talks, workshops, performances, panel discussions, and installations will provide you with a multi-sensory experience that expands beyond the printed page. Free and open to public, the event takes place on October 5th and 6th from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, visit VancouverArtBookFair.com.
Okay. What do you think about the effectiveness of the Truth and Reconciliation?
explicit language. So what you just heard was the song Maldic by Montreal-based Godspeed You Black Emperor. That tracks off their new album, Alleluia, Don't Bend, Ascend, which was the winner of this year's Polaris Prize. The Polaris Prize is unique in that the winner is not decided by record sales or popular vote. The jury is made up of what the Polaris Prize website describes as journalists, broadcasters, bloggers, programmers, and other experts in the field of devouring and deciphering new Canadian music. The criteria is up to the jury, so the power is really in the hands of the journalists. The jury this year featured Gregory Adams of the Georgia Strait, Gian Gameschi from Q, a handful of writers from Exclaim, Weird Canada, Much Music, and others from radio, TV, and print news, as well as many freelance writers. There's a long list put out in June, a short list in July, and then a gala in September where the winner is announced. The thing is, Godspeed was not present at the Polaris Gala this year to collect the award or the $30,000 prize. Instead, the band published a lengthy open letter to Polaris, which reads, "Hello Canada. Hello Canadian music writers. Thanks for the nomination. Thanks for the prize. Feels nice to be acknowledged by the troubled motherland when we so often feel orphaned here. And much respect for y'all who write about the local bands, who blow that horn loudly, because that trumpeting is crucial and necessary and important. And much respect to the freelancers especially, because freelancing is a hard fucking gig, and almost all of us are freelancers now, right? Falling and scrambling and hustling through these difficult times. So yes, we are grateful, and yes, we are humble, and we are shy to complain when we've been acknowledged thusly. But holy shit and holy cow, we've been plowing our fields on the margins of weird culture for about almost 20 years now, and this scene is pretty cool, but what it really fucking needs is an award show is not a thought that's ever crossed our minds." Three quick bullet points that almost anybody could agree on, maybe. Holding a gala during a time of austerity and normalized decline is a weird thing to do. Organizing a gala just so musicians can compete against each other for a novelty-sized check doesn't serve the cause of righteous music at all. Asking the Toyota Motor Company to help cover the tab for the gala during a summer where the melting northern ice caps are live streaming on the internet is fucking insane and comes across as tone-deaf to the current horrifying malaise. These are hard times for everybody, and musicians' blues are pretty low on the list of things in need of urgent correction. But, if the point of this prize and party is acknowledging music labor performed in the name of something other than quick money, well then maybe the next celebration should happen in a cruddier hall, without the corporate banners and culture overlords, and maybe a party thusly is long overdue. It would be truly nice to enjoy that hang, somewhere, sometime when the point wasn't just lazy money patting itself on the back. Give the money to the kids, let them put on their own goddamn parties. Give the money to the olds and let them try to write opuses in spite of it. But let the Much Music video stars fighting it out in the inconsequential middle without government culture money in their pockets. Us, we're going to use the money to try to set up programs so that prisoners in Quebec have musical instruments if they need them. Amen and amen. Apology for being such bores. We love you so much, / our country is fucked. XOXO, Godspeed You, Black Emperor. So that was the open letter to Polaris. Here's a little history of the band, if you're not familiar with these guys. Godspeed You Black Emperor was founded in Montreal back in 1994, originally consisting of three members. The music's highly complex, often being dubbed an orchestral rock or post-rock. They've had up to 15 members at one point, including a string section, but for the better part of the past 20 years they've been playing together, the band has consisted of 9 members. They released 3 albums from 1997 to 2002 before going on a hiatus in 2003 for about 7 years. Alleluia, Don't Descend, Ascend, released last year, has only 4 songs, including 2 that clock in just under 20 minutes apiece. For the most part, their music is instrumental, although their liner notes, concert monologues, and interviews are often full of politically charged messages. Beyond this, journalists like Fiona Sturgis, writing in The Independent, have suggested that their fans find their instrumental sound embodies a greater political statement than all the proselytizing of Gillespie or Bono. Beyond this, journalists like Fiona Sturgis, writing in The Independent, have suggested that their fans find their instrumental sound, quote, embodies a greater political statement than all the proselytizing of Gillespie or Bono. I sat down with J.C. Gibb, editor of Discorder magazine, Duncan McHugh, co-host of CITR's Duncan's Donuts, and Jonathan Q, a local music coordinator at CITR, to talk about Godspeed's response to the Polaris Prize. All right, so what was you guys' first impression when you heard about Godspeed turning down the Polaris Prize?
Well, I was just, like, someone had posted it to Facebook, and so I was just reading it, so I actually didn't really think much of it at the time.
They haven't turned it down, didn't they? Aren't they taking the money, the $30,000,
like,
and giving it to... Well, they FU'd
it was
Polaris.
Thanks, but no thanks.
But they still took it. They're still taking the money, Toyota's money, and they're still... They're just using it for musical education and
in prisons.
In prisons, yeah. in Quebec prisons.
Sorry, yeah, it'd be like, no thanks, but thanks. Like, they are accepting it, but, I don't know, it was pretty, like, you know, we don't believe in this. We don't believe in, like, what this is. We don't believe in this gala that they're having.
Well, they weren't there to accept the prize, pretty much. Do you think their criticism is grounded? Like, what they said in response to Polaris, is it legitimate criticism?
I think it's a difficult criticism to disagree with. It's just about whether that would have been the right venue for expressing that, or whether, like, their symbolic gesture really has any, like, whether they're making a calculated effort to actually try and change things, or whether they're just sort of airing out their laundry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So. I thought it was great. I think those are all pretty relevant criticisms.
Yeah.
I mean, some of their analogies were sort of, I mean, they're a touring band. They're burning tons of fossil fuels, driving around the continent touring. And really, there's lots of things to be kind of disgusted with in a time of austerity. And so a gala celebrating Canadian music is maybe one of the least offensive, or like a less offensive thing. But
A less metric one.
Well, yeah. Then burn the whole thing down. So I would agree with them, but I also think, like, it's a little too, maybe it was a little unnecessarily harsh. Mm-hmm. But yeah, good for them. I mean, they won it. I think they deserved it. And they can, Polaris seems to be honoring their right to do whatever they want with the music. So good for them.
JC?
One of my main, questions was like, what, like, okay, so if they didn't, like, really want the prize, then, like, why would they, you know, like, submit their names? But there isn't a submission process, there is no entry fee, like, it is decided, like, by Polaris themselves. So I remember that was gonna be one of my questions, is like, why would you bother, like, putting your name forward if you, like, necessarily didn't want to win? So
how much of this do you think has to do with just publicity? Like, is it a publicity stunt, more or less? Is that part of it?
I don't think so.
I wouldn't say so. Godspeed are very reluctant, like, towards any kind of publicity. It's just that when they tend to release statements, it's always in these grandiose group manifestos that express the will of the entire collective.
So I'm going to play a clip now of shortlist presenter Jessica Hopper on stage at the Polaris Gala talking about Godspeed's decision not to appear for the prize.
Godspeed, you Black Emperor, have chosen not to be here tonight. They wouldn't be Godspeed if they had. They've spent the last 20 years defying convention as well as our expectations of what it means to be an and. In the process, they've shown us exactly what kind of career you can have when you decide to say no.
So,
yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
It seems kind of like a weird response, doesn't it?
I don't know. I mean, what else are you going to do? Someone has to go up there and say something. It's not like Marlon Brando at the Oscars, which was maybe a bit more overwrought when he sent a First Nations woman up to collect his prize, which has its own merits, but definitely seemed more designed for sensationalism.
Well, what's, like, fascinated me more than, like, them, you know, their response to the prize has just been, like, everyone's reaction, because It's varied so much when people are like, yeah, you know, Godspeed to you, Godspeed, and some people are like, oh, who's Godspeed? Like, as opposed to people who are like offended that Tegan and Sarah didn't get it, right? I don't know. I find just like the like spectrum of responses like been the most fascinating part to me.
Just a quick note to wrap this up. The song Melodic, which I played at the beginning of this segment, seems to be named after the Bosnian Serb general Ratko Mladic, who is currently standing trial for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in relation to the Yugoslav wars. Make of that what you will. Just a warning, this program contains explicit language.
So, wonderful segment by Josh. That was our news today, September 27th. Today's show was produced by me, Nina, and with very wonderful contributions by Morgan, Christina, Josh, and Alistair. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.